This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Hello and welcome to By the Book, your weekly dose of all things literary.
And all things to do with celebrating the act of reading.
I'm Sharmila Ganesan.
I'm Lee Trelet.
And today we are actually going to be marking, I think, several significant dates. The biggest, I suppose, of which is the fact that we are coming to the first year of a pretty big change that Malaysia went through.
Yes.
The elections, of course, almost a year ago. For the first time, our country saw a change in government with Pakatan Harapan coming into power.
Yes, and a big part of the conversations that have gone on, and we're not necessarily going to use this show, I think, to get into the politics of the situation, but a big part that has gone on is about conversations surrounding political awareness, conversations surrounding political knowledge and understanding. And so we wanted to take the opportunity to use this show as a way to talk about the books that have helped to shape our understanding of politics and of the conversations within it.
I do think that when I try and look back to when I first started developing what you can loosely call a political consciousness, if there's ever such a thing,
yes,
it is from books, because I grew up without the internet, and people weren't nearly as openly talking about politics. And I got a lot of these frames of references from the books that I was reading.
Sure. And I think when we talk about politics, of course, we're not just necessarily talking about the electorate, about parliament,
right,
about things like that. I think for me, the books gave me a frame of understanding to appreciate what it is that politics actually does in our daily lives, mm-hmm. how it can impact the way we live, and how governments actually play a very large role in determining how the citizenry react to anything at all. And so, yeah, it's through books and stories that I've shaped that. So we should say off the bat that we don't necessarily have a lot of Malaysian books in the list.
No, we might have maybe one and a half, depending on if Singapore's shared history counts. But I do think that a lot of these concepts are universal ideas of what it means, what power means, what it means to live under systems, what it means to live under oppressive systems. So on that note, Lynn, do you want to get us started?
Well, sure. I mean, like we said, right, a lot of these ideas about politics, they come from the books that we read in our childhood. So I couldn't really look past this book that would have made it into our first episode, the one about books that shaped us anyway. So I'm just looking to shoehorn it in. It's The Diary of a Young Girl, or The Diary of Anne Frank.
Anti-Jewish decrees followed each other in quick succession. Jews must wear a yellow star. Jews must hand in their bicycles. Jews are banned from trams and are forbidden to drive. Jews are only allowed to do their shopping between 3 and 5 o'clock. Jews must be indoors by 8 o'clock. Jews are forbidden to visit theaters. Jews may not visit Christians. Jews must go to Jewish schools, and many more restrictions of a similar kind. So we could not do this, and were forbidden to do that. But life went on in spite of it all.
It tells the story of the Frank family, who were hiding in sort of a house within a house, I suppose, during the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. And it's a combination of the day-to-day musings of really just a girl coming into her teenage years, the little crushes, the little wonderings, the little fights that she has with her family, but also the fact that they are stuck. The fact that today we had to move, today mm-hmm. we had to change this, today we didn't get what we asked for. The realization of the lived experience, I guess, of living under the Nazi occupation, it really helped me understand what it might have been like, I suppose, living in wartime. And that led me down another rabbit hole of trying to understand how that came to be, what the Nazi Party stood for, what was going on in Europe during that time, which was a more helpful history lesson in many ways than what I actually got in school. So for that, you know, I have to thank The Diary of Anne Frank.
Anne Frank is such a great example of the way in which the politics of a situation is so beautifully told through the story of one person or one family. Because I read Anne Frank when I was very young. Certainly, I think too young to understand the complexity of what the Holocaust was about. But reading about it through the story of a girl who was, I suppose, not too far from my age, really did help me understand what it means to live in this society, in this time. And that's something that's not easy to do.
No, especially when we're talking about things like world wars.
Exactly.
Where there are really, really complex factors and, you know, that are at play to create the situation. It helps to boil it down to, this is how it was for one person. Mm-hmm. Now multiply that by a million, you know? And that has always been just, I guess, one of my earliest exercises in empathy, but also then in understanding, yeah, the political circumstances that led to this one story existing. Mm. Yeah, and also one of my earliest experiences with heartbreak, because it is just a very heartbreaking story.
Oh, Anne Frank is just, I don't even know if I can revisit it now, because it's sort of, I have to put aside time to be ready to feel when I read it.
Yes, and to actually putting aside time after.
Yes.
The question is what happens after, right? So yeah, to kick things off on a cheerful note, it's The Diary of Anne Frank. That's
what we're talking about politics. It wasn't going to be very cheerful to begin with.
Fair enough.
That said, I think one way in which I found that it is, one way in which politics can be made accessible, and the first time that I learned this and I understood this was through the brilliance of George Orwell's Animal Farm. I again read Animal Farm when I was maybe slightly too young to understand what communism really was, especially Stalinism. But then as I was reading the book, and I think I sort of went into it not knowing exactly what it was. I knew that it was the story of animals in a farm, but also that they were supposed to represent other things.
The actual details of the story didn't come to me for some time, until one day I saw a little boy, perhaps 10 years old, driving a huge cart horse along a narrow path and whipping it every time it tried to turn. It struck me that if only such animals became aware of their strength, we would have no power over them, and that men exploit animals in much the same way that the rich exploit the proletariat.
And then by the end of the book, I felt like I'd had my consciousness awakened to what this kind of system could mean when people are living under it.
It's a near perfect allegory, I think.
It is.
Animal Farm. Because it works on that just one single level. If you're young and you're just reading it as, oh, hey, here's a bunch of cheerful animals figuring out how to make things work
right
on the farm. I mean, yes, there is still a bit of, oof, this doesn't feel quite right. But on a story level, it works. I think one of the biggest problems when people try to write political allegories is that you add layer upon layer of what you might perceive as sophistication.
Yes.
And instead, it just muddies the waters. Whereas that is just a clean, incisive, sharp stab to the heart. And you just go, oof.
Exactly.
I read Animal Farm when I was a little bit older. So when I say a little bit older, I mean an adult. So by the time I read Animal
Farm. Just a little bit.
Just tiny. By the time I read Animal Farm, I was fully aware of George Orwell's reputation. I was fully aware of what it meant and what it was supposed to mean, and it still worked for me on every level. It's witty, it's also kind of horrifying in the
yes,
best way.
Yeah.
And best of all, it is just such a quick read that you almost have no excuse not to pick it up, because it really is so slim. It's not a 1984, mm-hmm. which again follows these similar themes,
yeah.
right? But that's a bit more of a, you know, a thicker novel. Animal Farm, really, anyone can pick up and finish in a day.
No, and Animal Farm is actually a story that is, it's entertaining in its own right.
Yeah.
So as you said earlier, I think it doesn't wear its allegorical leanings on its sleeve. It doesn't pretend, or rather it doesn't use the idea that it is satire, it is poking at a system, as an excuse to not write a darn good story.
Mm.
And Animal Farm, I think, is one of those that, you know, it's funny, you laugh, and then at the same time you feel, oh dear, like this, how does this pan out in real life? How does this pan out if Napoleon was a real leader that you had to contend with?
Actually, you do feel your stomach turn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the best part is that the laughter that happened a little bit earlier, that makes the stomach turning that much more sickening.
Yes.
So yeah, just Animal Farm's a great recommendation.
So we will be taking a break now. And when we come back, we will continue this discussion on books that resonated with us in terms of their politics. This is By the Book, and you are listening to BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha.
BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back. This is By the Book. I am Sharmila Ganesan.
I'm Lee Chui Lin.
And we're talking about, well, political books, I suppose.
Because we're looking forward to the one-year anniversary of May 9th, right, with that big momentous change of power. Like we said earlier, not necessarily getting into how things are going at the moment.
That is a whole other show.
Yes, I really think so. But instead, we're just sticking to, the books that have kind of helped shape our understanding of politics as a whole, right?
Yes. And what was interesting when Lynn and I were having this discussion earlier is that we both seem to have picked books that come from a slightly, I suppose, not a genre that many people would automatically go to when they talk about politics, which is the graphic novel.
Having said that, I think my pick is one that a lot of people will probably share.
Yes.
Because it is Watchmen.
I love Watchmen.
It's so great. And I know that the phrase, who watches the Watchmen, doesn't come from Watchmen, but it certainly has been used a lot in that context. So, how do you begin to tell the story of Watchmen?
Watchmen, one of us died tonight. Somebody knows why. Somebody knows.
I heard he'd been working for the government. Maybe it was a political killing.
Maybe someone's picking off costumed heroes. What if that's why someone wants us out of the way? So we can't do anything to stop it. An attack on one is an attack on all of us.
Watchmen are over. What do you suggest we do about it?
Retribution.
It is an alternate timeline where superheroes are real.
Are a thing, and yet many of them have been forced into retirement. And really, I guess what it is the whole story is based on the idea of what many, many superhero stories are based on, which is how do you actually achieve world peace in our times, really is what it comes down to, and the ways and means by which people try and get there. But in the course of it, it covers things like Vietnam, it covers things like Nixon, at least in American politics, and more than that, it shapes an, I suppose in the wrong hands, it would lead to a very conspiratorial sort of thinking. But it really asks you to question when things happen, why do they happen? Why is the story being told to you and who is it benefiting?
Right.
And also the people that you think are your heroes, are they? The people that you think are your villains, are they? And it does so in this crazy, multi-layered, amazingly told example of the genre. I don't think that Watchmen would have worked as well if it weren't a graphic novel.
No, absolutely not. I cannot see it working as a straight novel. Is that such a thing? A non-graphic novel.
Right.
Because the visuals are such an important part, and the way it overlaps narratives, the way it lays things next to each other, it reveals one thing and then hides another. I think that is something that's so unique to the visual form.
Which is why there hasn't really been all that much success when it comes to adapting Watchmen, right? It is perfect in its form, and it also, I left it feeling like I needed to do a lot of thinking, you know, like I needed to mull over all those questions that I just threw out into the world as well. And I think anything that manages to get you to do that is great, helps that it's a great story, helps that it's really regarded by many as the pinnacle of the graphic novel. So yeah, Watchmen, so good.
And, you know, interestingly enough, when I think about The Watchmen, Watchmen was one of those books that I revisited right before elections last year. For some reason, I felt drawn to wanting to read it.
For some reason,
because, you know, it's not like I don't go back to it every couple of years anyway. And I felt one of the things that I really felt was how much those issues, the things that Alan Moore talks about in the novel, resonates. How many years has it been? 30 years later? And with a place like Malaysia, which I'm sure at that time wasn't really even on his radar when he was writing the story.
Yeah, and post GE14 also with we're going to hold you accountable being sort of the main theme, right? And not just here at the station. I think for many people, it was a sense of, okay, we've put up with a lot And now we're going to hold you accountable always. And that idea of accountability mm-hmm. is expressed so strongly and viscerally in Watchmen that, yeah, it's a great book to revisit.
So to bring things back to maybe a slightly more local front, again, quite controversially because I'm not sure how local Singapore is, but my pick in terms of a graphic novel that also had that sort of deep political element was Sunny Liu's The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai.
So The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai is a book about Singapore's history told through the lens of a fictional comic artist called Charlie Chan. I was reading books on comics, like history of comics, and I realized that whenever you talked about a comic book, you know, you had to understand it within the context of its history, where it came from, when it was created. So I thought it'd be interesting to flip that around and explore Singapore's history through a comics history, except you create a fictional one to make it more interesting.
So Sunny Liu is Singaporean, and he essentially writes this, again, it's quite difficult to describe. When you read it, you first get the, well, now I'm wondering whether I should spoil it or not. Well, okay, it's ostensibly an autobiographical account of a comic book artist who grew up before an independent Singapore. And it kind of traces the story of his career and his development of his art with the story of Singapore and the story of Lee Kuan Yew. And the comic was actually quite controversial in Singapore.
Of course it was.
You know, it was initially given a government grant, and then they had the government grant withdrawn because I think they weren't entirely happy with the subject. And Sunny Liu really, I think, again, it's this case of the art and the story coming together in a way that really couldn't be told anywhere else. And again, I think it being local enough anyway.
I think we can use the word local. It seems a bit silly to use the word regional for something like this. So I think local works.
Close to home. And there's this one page where he does a sort of a portrait of Lee Kuan Yew. And to me, I was just like, this is exactly what it means to have storytelling done in this form. I love Sunny Liu's work. And I really think that he did, in terms of capturing what it means to be Singapore today, the issues of things like surveillance, the top-down approach, and where that comes from and what it means to Singapore today. Really, really brilliant work in terms of showing that to both people who live there and people from outside.
And the title of that again was?
The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai.
Okay, I've not read it, but you've made it sound very intriguing indeed. I plan to.
I hope you get out of it what I did.
For my last pick then, we asked, I can safely say regional, so we're staying within the region. I guess what I'm choosing has a very similar theme of oppressive governments for some reason, but they all also kind of spawned off separate areas of research for me. So that's how I made my picks, because they were all just things that once I read it, I felt like I needed to know more. And the last book that really did that for me in this respect was Life and Death in Shanghai, and it was written by Nian Cheng.
Yeah, I've not read that.
It's the story of one woman again, one woman's account of surviving brutal interrogations during the time of the Cultural Revolution. So she was a Western-educated Chinese woman who had been working for Shell, and so she had been identified as a possible foreign spy and picked up and just, yeah, interrogated. And it tells the story of how she survives that, how she used Mao's teachings to kind of work her way around what was going on. It also talks about the long-lasting effects that all those beatings, all those deprivations took on her even after she left prison, mm-hmm. how she lost her family in many ways to what happened. And it spawned off a period of time in my life where I was reading an awful lot about China and the Cultural Revolution to just understand, where was this coming from? What is this red book? You know, what is the issue here? And to gain what turned out to be a deeper understanding of communism and socialism and just all these different concepts as they were being expressed through these very turbulent times. It's a fascinating read. I read it, I think I came to it at the right point because I was a curious teenager and it was just knowledge that I didn't have. So Life and Death in Shanghai by Nian Cheng. It's great.
I love this idea, actually, of learning about the politics or a political system through the story of a person, because I think that seems to be a thread that runs through many of these books that resonate with people, because systems and even just politics can seem so overwhelming.
And dry sometimes.
And dry and difficult and often unrelatable.
So I find that some people really do relate very well to factual books, right?
Yes.
To here is what this is, here is where it came from, this is the seat, you know, and just I've never been able to find my way through those books with any real ease. Mm-hmm. I needed to get there through a story.
Yeah.
That's just me, and I guess you, but it helped me. It helped me greatly in terms of always humanizing what seemed to be this grand system that just affected millions of people at a time.
Mm-hmm. One of the most recent experiences that I had with that is actually a book by Bernice Chowley, Once We Were There. It may not necessarily be a book that I am going to wholeheartedly say I loved. There were parts of it that I liked very much. And I think it was also the timing that I read it in. I read it right before the elections again. And she writes about the Reformasi in the late 90s.
Mm.
And so this sort of this weird mental space, because here we are, you know, I remember when I started reading the book, Tun Mahathir had just been announced as Prime Minister-elect for Pakatan Harapan. And meanwhile, I'm reading this book that's talking about this time in our history when he was, and the book very much positions him as the person who was responsible for this giant revolution that Malaysia was going through.
Yeah.
And then that schism between him and Anwar Ibrahim. And so I think it was for me reading our politics and our political history on the page. So that was something that was very exciting. And I could feel it. Like I was very young, I'd like to say. I was a teenager. I was a teenager in the late 90s. So a lot of this sort of went over my head a little bit.
Yeah.
So now when I read back, I was reading it as a spectator. And at the same time, I also knew what was to come. So there was a weird mix of excitement and also sadness and anticipation of the new elections. And then now, a year later, I'm thinking, well, again, there's a lot of ambivalence mixed in with that experience.
It is, I think it's probably more of an intimate experience reading about our experience, mm-hmm. our politics, our history, than it is when you read that of another country where there is a remove, right? Because I'm just thinking about myself in that position as well. And I completely get it. There are things that you know now that you did not know then.
Yes.
So in a way, you're reading it through the eyes of the 15-year-old or 17-year-old that you were in 1998, mm-hmm. you know, and at the same time, also having to have the knowledge and burden of, well, in 2019 or in 2018, here we are.
And it kind of makes me hope and wish that we read more books about this period in our Malaysian history. And maybe 10 years from now, I'd like to be able to read those and remember what I felt at this time.
Let us know what your favorite political books have been, or what books have been instrumental in shaping your consciousness. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 just to let us know, because I'd be really interested to know what else everyone's been reading.
And now we'd like to take you into a segment that we call Footnotes.
Yes.
We're still very excited about it, and we're still trying to figure out exactly what we put in here every week.
So far, it's been quite a good collection of recommendations, of little musings, of news. We'll see if we can keep it this random. Really.
Some randomness is good.
Yes. So we spent the first bit of the show, or rather the bulk of the show, really focusing on one day, May 9th. But there is another day that occurs every year.
Mm-hmm.
In May, and that is, of course, Mother's Day.
Yes, which is coming up this Sunday, actually. And we thought it would be interesting to kind of talk about mothers in literature.
Yes, because it is a surprisingly complex subject.
I know.
I think when we first floated this notion, we were both like, ah, this is going to be great. It's going to be easy. And then when you do a little bit more, you know, kind of mulling over your bookshelves, a bit of Google, you realize that it is a little bit hard, because are we only talking about good mothers,
right.
Whatever a good mother is, yes. You know, identified as being. We're certainly not going to take the time to focus on all the bad mothers in literature.
Of which there are way too many and way too... It's such an overused trope.
Yes, it is. I think... Often you just need someone to blame, right? It's like, hey, we need someone to blame for our protagonist's commitment issues. It was the mom.
Yeah.
Mom always left, you know. So it turned into a bit of a complex thing. Then we realized probably that issue of complexity was the topic itself.
I think so. I mean, I think that is, and especially at the time that we are in now, what does it mean to be a mother is almost like asking, what does it mean to be a woman? What does it mean to have a life that doesn't necessarily have to revolve around other people?
Yes. So with that in mind, our two picks, I suppose,
yeah,
of books that have explored more complicated aspects of motherhood are, let's start with yours.
Well, mine is actually quite complicated because I'm still working out how I feel about this character, is Eva Kachadourian from We Need to Talk About Kevin by Lionel Shriver. The book is about... Essentially, it's inspired by the school shootings that happened in America. And long story short, it's about a family whose son turns out to be a school shooter. But it's told from the point of view of the mother.
You just have to rock him a little bit.
Could you say mommy?
No.
Shouldn't he be talking by now?
I wouldn't worry about it.
Ball? No.
He's just a boy. Just a sweet little boy.
Just because you're used to something doesn't mean you like it. Used to me.
First he cries too much, then he's too quiet, and you see it as some kind of personal vendetta?
You think I'm exaggerating?
It's a painful, beautiful read. It really is. And, you know, because you're reading it from her point of view, and she's very much the unreliable narrator, you can't help but deal with these questions of what does it mean to be a parent? What does it mean to love a child? What does it mean when you're a mother who can't connect with your child, who doesn't like being that child's mother, who likes one child more than the other? And then at the end of the day, if you tried your very best and your child still doesn't turn out the way you had hoped, and in this case, very much so, where does the question of blame lie?
Right.
And I think Lionel Shriver does a really good job of breaking these issues down and not giving us easy answers, which is why I think 10 years after I read the book, the character of Eva still sticks in my mind.
So I haven't read We Need to Talk About Kevin. I know it. You know, I know that there was a movie as well. Mm-hmm. I've always really wanted to, and yet I've always felt a sense of trepidation approaching it because it's such a dark story.
It is, it is.
So, yes, but I really want to give it a go. My pick is going to be Helen Oyeyemi's Boy Snowbird.
My book, Boy Snowbird, is about a wicked stepmother and her biological daughter and her stepdaughter. It's set in 1950s America, and it deals with their relationships with each other. I'm very interested in women who, strange women, I suppose, women who are for some reason not able to express emotion in a way that wins them friends. So I like unsympathetic heroines and wicked stepmothers and the evil fairy that shows up in Sleeping Beauty. Like, I'm always most interested in that character in the story.
So it tells the story of, in a sense, Snow White, and in a sense, Snow White's stepmother.
Right.
In a sense. But it is not a modern retelling of a fairy tale. Instead, I think it uses the structure and framework of the fairy tale that you know in order to tell a wholly different story. And in it, there is a woman named Boy Novak who does things very much for her own purposes. She's not warm. She's not the warmest person, nor is she the most sympathetic. And yet you understand her motivations and why it is that she does what she does, why it is that she loves or does not love mm-hmm. the people that she does. And it, like We Need to Talk About Kevin in some ways, I suppose, it tells the story also of favoritism,
yeah,
of trying to love your child through trying times. But it does it all in a very... The language is beautiful, and there's a lightness of touch that almost makes you feel like this isn't the story that you're reading. I don't know how to describe it beyond saying that that's where the fairy tale element comes in, mm-hmm. I think, where you're not ever entirely sure where we are. And it's a great read. I mean, if you're familiar with Helen Oyeyemi, she does frequently include fairy tale elements, mythological yes. elements yeah. into her work. So this is similar, and it's a painful yet beautiful read.
And that's the difficulty with, I think, finding mothers. And that's precisely why we had this challenge, which is that there are way too many cliches when it comes to what it means to be a good mother, what it yeah. means to be a bad mother. And often the reality of it is that most people fall somewhere in the middle. Very few people are trying to be bad mothers. Very few people achieve being the perfect mother either.
And at least in my experience of reading, there haven't been that many stories told specifically from the point of view of a mother where it wasn't just a story about motherhood.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, where...
Instead of personhood.
Yes, yeah. Precisely. So that's an interesting area to explore, I think. Perhaps as more people begin to write honestly, mm-hmm. you know, and to attempt to explore this, because we're in a time now where it feels more permissible yes. for someone to admit, perhaps being a mother has not been the experience that I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And I think when we kind of play in this area, we're going to get somewhere.
I think so too. Well, that only leaves us with wishing all of you lovely mothers out there Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day. We hope it hasn't been too much of a downer, this little segment.
Well, on that note, you've been listening to Buy the Book on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.